Brian Wansink. Welcome to Writer's Voice.
I'm pleased to be with you.
You are the director of the Cornell Food and Brand Lab, and a lot of what you found out that you put in your book, you found out from that lab. Tell us about it, and also tell us about the restaurant, the Spice Box.
Okay. Well, the lab is a series of rooms that are connected together to my office, actually, and they've got one-way mirrors, we've got hidden cameras, we have scales underneath plates. We've got a lot of things like this that can enable us to change something and observe how it influences how much somebody eats or how much they like food. So we can change the lighting, we can change plate size, we can change the variety of food we give people, we can have it be distracting or not distracting, we can turn on different TV shows. We can do all this in a really, really nice, controlled environment that within 3 hours we can change to look like a kitchen or a dining room or a den or a living room. And what happens is, if once we find out that something works in a lab, then what we'll do is we'll move out into the real world and we'll examine this in movie theaters or in restaurants or in bars or at parties to see if the things we find that work in the lab also translate into real life. And when you asked about the Spice Box, too, and the Spice Box is actually, it's similar. What it is it's a restaurant that's only open one day a week, and people come there and they pay a prefix. They pay like about $25 for a prefix menu, and we do the exact same thing in there. We might change the name or label on a wine and see how it influences how much of a meal people eat. We might change the lighting. We might have something unusual happen that throws people off to see how they respond in the way they eat. It enables us, again, to test the very specific things that we think are almost invisible to most people, but which influence how much they eat or how much they like food.
Well, tell us some of those things. Like, for example, what happens when you change the label on a wine?
Okay. Well, we actually did do that in the Spice Box. What we did is we brought people in for a nice French prefix meal. And it was the middle of February and cold night. We said, hey, thanks for keeping your reservation. Because you kept the reservation, we'd like to offer you a complimentary glass of wine. And what we did was we had a very cheap bottle of $2 bottle of wine that we had soaked the label off. And what we did is we put on fake labels, which said that it was either this Cabernet from California, a place known for wine, respected for wine, or we put on a label that said a Cabernet from North Dakota. Not a place known for wine, not necessarily a place very well respected for wine. And we know from a prior study that when people end up drinking something that they believe is going to taste good, they do evaluate it as better. They essentially look for those good qualities and those good aspects, and their taste buds conveniently confirm their expectations. Well, in this case, we weren't interested in what they wine tastes like. We were interested in how it influenced the rest of the meal and what we found. If people thought they're eating a California, drinking a California wine, they loved the food. They ate 10 minutes longer. They ate 11% more of the food. If they had one from North Dakota, just wasn't as good. They just finished up dinner and left, and they left a lot more of their food in their plate.
So their expectations determined how they actually tasted or enjoyed the food.
You know, absolutely. But, I mean, you know, we've known this for a lot of studies we've done in cafeterias. We've gone to cafeterias into restaurants, and we've changed the names of the menus. So, you know, 1 week the menu item would be called seafood fillet, and the next week it'd be called succulent Italian seafood fillet. Well, in reality, it's just like a dried up fish stick. But the people who eat the thing that they believe is a succulent Italian seafood fillet, I mean, they rate the foods better, they rate the restaurant as better, and after they finish eating, they actually believe that the chef has had probably 1 to 2 years of culinary training overseas.
Now, why do you think people do? Now, you've mentioned two things. One was a $2 bottle of wine.
Yeah, $2 chuck.
And the other is exactly $2 chuck. And the other was from a box of, I assume, frozen dried up fish sticks, right?
Yeah. So this is bad cafeteria seafood.
Yeah. So what is it that gets people to fool themselves that something tastes good that really doesn't taste that great?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, what's going on is we have so many things going on in our life that our life pretty much becomes filled with mindless eating because we parallel process things, we end up doing a lot of stuff at the same time, and eating can be a fairly automatic activity, as can the evaluation of food. So we're probably more interested in what our dinner mates are talking about or how work's going or something like that. So the evaluation of food becomes very peripheral. And when something's very peripheral, we end up being very easily influenced by the little cues around us, whether it be names and labels or whether it be packages and plates or whether it be music and lighting.
So your book is Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. And you also talk about something called the mindless margin. What is that?
Well, what happens is that the majority of people who gain weight in a year gain it at less than 2 to 3 pounds a year. I mean, that's a difference of 25 calories. And 25 calories extra a day is really, you know, nothing more than about 5 M&Ms or about 8 Tic Tacs. So there's very few calories we eat in excess every day that lead us to gain weight. The mindless margin is the number of calories we can trim out of our day without noticing it physiologically, without noticing it psychologically, that can end up leading to weight loss. And we estimate that very, very, very conservatively to be as much as 300 calories. Meaning if we come up with three little changes that cut 300 calories out of our day, we're not going to miss it from a physiological or psychological standpoint. We're not going to have headaches. We're not going to have stomach growling. But over the course of a year, 300 extra calories, 300 less calories a day translates into 30 less pounds at the end of the year. And that's the mindless margin.
And we're talking with Brian Wanzink, and the book is Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. You know, I have to say, I was really astonished. I mean, the idea that one could lose 30 pounds almost effortlessly, well, that's going to be the subject of most of what we talk about today, how you actually do that, really surprised me. Have you seen this work with people? I mean, do you know people that's worked with?
Yeah, actually, we know it actually works for most of the people in the lab. Most of the people who start in the lab, we know what cues lead people to overeat, so we gradually find that people, you know, start doing the small things that our study suggests, and all of a sudden we find people losing quite a bit of weight very quickly. I mean, not very quickly, but over the course of the year, we'll find people will drop down to a low BMI very, very quickly.
You mean your colleagues?
Yeah, my colleagues. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Wow. So let's talk about some of those cues. I have to say, this is a hugely entertaining book. And I had to laugh out loud at some of the experiments that you did. One of them was the bottomless soup bowl.
Well, what happens is most people believe they're master and commander of all their food choices. I mean, they believe that they know when they're full. In reality, we have very little idea when we're full sometimes because we end up eating largely with our eyes instead of our stomach. I mean, at the extremes, we'd know we were full, but in the middle, we're not really that aware of being full. And if you're to ask most people, when are you through eating? Most people would say, I'm pretty much through eating when the plate's empty or when my bowl's empty. We thought we'd figure out what happens if the plate never empties. What happens if your bowl never empties? And we designed these refillable soup bowls, these bottomless soup bowls, where we drilled holes in the bottom of bowls and we drilled holes through the table and connected using food-grade tubing the bowl through the table over to a big 6-quart cauldron of soup. Now, in doing this, a person could theoretically eat 6 quarts of soup before they ever hit the bottom of the soup bowl, because as they eat, the level goes down, but then it slowly, slowly, slowly refills itself. And what we find is that when we bring people in for lunch and they eat away, we stop them after 20 minutes. They've eaten 73% more soup in a refillable soup bowl than they did a normal one. Yet, when we ask them to rate how full they are, they don't rate themselves as being any more full. Because after all, I mean, they've only eaten half a bowl of soup. There's still a half a bowl left. How can they be full?
But they did say that the soup was good and filling.
Yeah, they did. They did like the taste of the soup, even though they ended up, you know, eating it ad nauseum.
You know, how do you guys think up these experiments? You know, I have this image that you all sit around a table and you do a lot of chuckling.
Oh, yeah, we do. We've got very funny people in the lab, and we've always, I mean, somebody who'd be attracted to something as is non-traditional in academics is food psychology. That person's got to have a good sense of humor.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, you know, a couple of weeks ago, I decided I needed to go on a crash diet because I'm going to be going to an award ceremony, and actually, in all modesty, I'm going to be one of the people getting me an award for a documentary I did last year. And I thought, oh my God, now I have got to lose those extra 10 pounds. So I went on the Atkins diet. Mm-hmm. And within 3 days, I'd had enough.
Well, that's one thing about that deprivation diets is people can lose weight on them, but not mere mortals. Boy, I think the people who can really lose a lot of weight on these, it's got to become a full-time job.
Mm-hmm.
I had the good fortune to work and write a number of things with Mike Huckabee, who's the governor of Arkansas, and who's ended up losing about 120 pounds in a year just through discipline and exercise. And so we know it can be done, but for most of us, most people don't want to lose 120 pounds. Most people would be happy. In fact, a recent study we did showed that most people, around 80%, would be happy if they lost 20 pounds or less,
mm-hmm.
Actually 18 pounds or less. And for 18 pounds or less, boy, going on a deprivation diet is just not going to cut it for most of us. It's a whole lot easier to just trim 100, 150 calories out of your day, and at the end of the year, you'll easily be 10 or 15 pounds less without even knowing you've been on a diet.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with food psychologist Brian Wansink about his book, Mindless Eating. You talked about the mindless margin, how we mm-hmm. mindlessly put on the weight. And, of course, that leads to also then, you know, setting things up in your life so that you mindlessly lose weight, I think, is kind of the point of your book.
Absolutely, yes.
I wanted to ask you, what are some of the major cues or major ways that people are mindless about food? I mean, you talked about, you know, that we're distracted a bit. I wonder if you could talk more about that and some of the other ways also that we set ourselves up for failing to lose weight.
Mm. Well, one thing is that we make over 200 food decisions a day. I mean, we think we make about 15. In reality, we make well over 200 food decisions a day. Even for breakfast, we're deciding which cereal to have, but how much to pour, whether to put skim milk or whole milk, whether to put sugar on it, whether to cut a banana. And we make 15 decisions before we even have a bite to eat. But the thing is, we're not even aware of having made those. And so at every one of those points when we make a decision, whether it be how much milk to pour or how much cereal to pour, we can easily be influenced by a peripheral cue that suggests that we maybe pour a little bit more than we otherwise would have. The bowl size, for instance, will encourage us to pour more. The size of the container of milk is going to lead us to pour more. A huge cereal box will have us pour more. Mm-hmm. All these things have very subtle influences. But as we know, hey, very small influences that just lead us to eat 25 calories more lead us to gain 2.5 pounds over the course of a year. And so that's what we need to target at turning around.
Well, what would you do with that? You know, you got your Cheerios box. You got the economy size. So it's a big one.
Yeah.
So what do you do?
Well, I mean, you know, one thing would be as simple as say, you know, buy a smaller box. But, you know, that's ridiculous for a lot of us because we want to buy the economy size because we save a lot of money. An easier thing to do would just be to simply use smaller bowls and put the box of cereal not on the table, but leave it on the counter. Hey, you can have seconds if you want to. But we find that simply having something 6 feet away, whether it be a candy dish or a cereal box or a bowl of pasta, leads people to end up eating less over the course of their meal because at some point you just don't mindlessly pour another bowl. You say, do I really want some? And that 6 feet gives you pause to say, am I really hungry? And oftentimes, half the time, in some of our studies, the answer is no.
Half the time.
Yeah, we did a series of studies that were it was fun. It was with secretaries of the university, and this was when I was at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and we enlisted a number of secretaries in the study and gave them a month's worth of chocolates. These are Hershey Kisses, and put them. We either placed them on their desk, or we placed them just 6 feet from their desk, and every single night we went and refilled all these bowls, counting how many they'd eaten. And we found that the typical person with a bowl on their desk ended up eating about 9 of these Hershey Kisses every single day, which is about 225 calories. If it was moved just 6 feet off their desk, the exact same person would end up eating four candies, which is about 100 calories. So simply having it on her desk, if she did it every day for a year, she'd be 12 pounds heavier. But having it 6 feet, it was interesting when we did the debriefing and we talked to people and you say, is it that much of a hassle just to walk two steps? Is that why you ate so few candies when it was moved off your desk? They'd say, no, it's not that it's much of a hassle. It's just that that 6 feet gave me pause to ask myself, hey, am I really that hungry? Half the time they asked themselves that, they came up with the answer, no.
Right, and also it was out of their line of vision. You know, it's funny you said secretaries in the universities because I just noticed that every secretary I know has a bowl of candy on her desk.
No, we call them social magnets. When we'll talk to people that are perpetually dieting, they'll say, hey, why do you have that bowl on your desk? You know what's going to happen. They go, yeah, but, you know, it's a conversation piece. People come by, they'll stop by, they'll talk. I make people smile when they stop by. Well, hey, we've got about 400 candy dishes in our lab because that's basically, you know, a lot of happening in a food lab. People stop by expecting to have food. But what we've done is we just replaced all the candy we like with candy we don't like. So instead of having the chocolates and things, we've replaced it with sweet and sour candies like, you know, sweet tarts and things like that, which we don't like quite so much. Hey, there's no temptation for us, but people still stop by.
Hmm. And you mentioned portion, you know, the size of the bowl. What about the size of the food, the size of the portions? I mean, what's happened to these over the last, you know, in the last 30 years?
Oh, well, the same thing has happened to our kitchens. They've gotten bigger and bigger and bigger because why? Well, because we can afford it, because we're a country with a lot of space. And so we're always looking for value. And the first time that a restaurant decides to increase the size of its fries by 25%, its competitors have a choice. They can either increase the size of their fries 25% and be seen as an equal bargain, or they can keep them where they're at and be seen as expensive. So what we have is sort of an escalation of competition among restaurants.
Yeah, you know, it's always very frustrating to me because even around here, which is kind of, you know, you live in Ithaca, is that right?
Yes, yes.
Well, this is kind of the alternative Ithaca here.
Yeah, exactly.
In the Pioneer Valley. And there are a lot of really wonderful little cafes that have, you know, a lot of good healthy food in them, but the size of their cookies, my goodness, are the size of dinner plates. You know, and when you ask, do you have anything that's smaller? No, they don't.
No, why would we have that? That's right. Well, you know, one of the real dangers that goes on in some of these places is a health halo, too, that you can have a very wonderful restaurant that makes very healthy food, but there's a tendency that we fall into, and this is a tendency of applying this health halo to, first of all, everything that a restaurant like that makes, but second of all, what it leads us to do is to compensate. We call it compensating behavior. So, for instance, we find when people eat what they consider to be a relatively healthy lunch, they're more likely to order chips and order cookies than when they eat something that they know is otherwise fairly indulgent. So in one study, we call them a Subway study, we found that people who ate, we intercepted people as they left either Subways or McDonald's that were within half a block of each other, and we found that the people leaving McDonald's, of course, they ate more food and they ate more calories. They ate about 1,000 calories, but they estimated that they ate about 900. The people leaving Subway ate less calories. They ate about 700 calories, but they estimated they ate about 400. Because what happened? Hey, they believed everything they ate there was healthy, but that didn't include the cheese. It didn't include the mayonnaise. It didn't include the chips, and it didn't include the cookies they ordered.
And they didn't know how many. You said people consistently underestimate the amount of calories that they take in.
Every single one of us underestimates the number of calories we take in by an average of 20%. But that's those who are of normal weight. If somebody's heavy, they underestimate it by closer to 40 or 50%.
Why is that?
Well, it's interesting. In the past, clinicians have treated this, when they've treated a heavy person who's come in for diet counseling, they often say, well, you are underreporting what you eat because either you don't have the knowledge to know what you're eating, you know, you're ignorant, or because you're lying to yourself or you're lying to us. And holy cow, that would be the end of the counseling session as far as I'd be concerned, if you know, if somebody would treat you that way. What we found in studies that happens is that regardless of whether a person is popsicle, skinny, or heavy, everybody underestimates the size of a very, very large meal. Okay, let's say, for instance, it's a 2,000-calorie Thanksgiving dinner. The heavy person and the skinny person alike are going to estimate that same dinner as being about 1,000 calories. And it has nothing to do with their weight. It's just that really huge meals tend to be underestimated in a mathematical, predictable way by everybody. The problem is that heavy people just eat a lot more 2,000-calorie meals than the skinny person.
We're talking with Brian Wansink about his book, Mindless Eating. Now, you did mention Thanksgiving, and we're broadcasting this, unfortunately, the day after Thanksgiving.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm sure people will still have plenty of leftovers.
Oh, they will.
So this will be good advice for them. And I tell you the truth, I'm always afraid, you know, because I love Thanksgiving and I love the good food. But I know that when I see the groaning board that has, you know, 20 different dishes on it and 5 different desserts, well, I want to have a little taste of each one of them. And even if I just take a tablespoon of each one, well, I end up with, the Himalayan mountains on my plate.
Oh, that is true. Well, there's a couple things to do in that case like that. If it's a buffet line, what you can do is you can just simply put 2 items on your plate at any one time and kind of go back. And that ends up being nice because you eat the things you like best first. And eventually, going back for thirds or fourths is okay, but not fifths or sixths, and you decide you've had enough. That's one thing. A better thing to do if you're doing a sit-down dinner with other people is, when you do this, use what we call the half-plate rule. Now, a lot of us don't have a benchmark as to what's right to eat and how much to eat, but if you use the half-plate rule, it gives you that benchmark. The half-plate rule is you simply say, look, half my plate, I can put anything I want to. The other half of the plate has to be fruits, or has to be, you know, vegetables, salads, and fruits. If the other half is all meat and carbos, hey, that's fine. But at least half the plate has to be vegetables, fruits, and salads. What that leads people to do is at least to fill up in some of the less calorie-dense stuff.
Right. And so they're actually eating healthily, and then they're not quite so hungry. But what about that dessert pouch? You know, there's that extra dessert pouch. Because no matter how much I fill up on the vegetables, I'm still ready to eat 3 desserts if they're in front of me.
Well, one thing you can do with desserts is you can see them as part of a larger meal. So, for instance, you don't want to go through the entire meal kind of complaining about how you're on a diet and how it's ruining your diet. Because, you know, you're going to have less fun, and believe me, everybody around you is not going to be grateful for it either. So one thing to do is to give yourself the freedom to eat some of the things you want by saying, hey, look, you know, in addition to the main central dishes, if you're at a restaurant, it'd be the appetizer, or it'd be the entree. In addition to these main central dishes, you know, I can have 2 other items. That could be, you know, the appetizer or the chips that were passed around before the dinner. It could be the bread that's passed around at dinner. It could be wine if you're having wine, or it could be a dessert. You can have any 2 of those items, but you can't have all 4. The problem with desserts comes in not necessarily because of the dessert, but because of the fact that prior to that dessert, we had had the bread. We had had all the appetizers that were passed around. We had had all the side dishes.
And does this work for you too, a Thanksgiving dinner?
Yeah. In some cases, there's some meals that just really aren't really worth monitoring tremendously closely.
Right.
And like a Thanksgiving dinner, or if a person was on a cruise and they're trying to watch their weight, well, that's sort of a bad idea. You shouldn't be on a cruise because you're losing all the advantage of being on a cruise. In some situations, hey, they come around so seldom, it's not really worth obsessing about that one situation. Hey, but tell you what, the day after Thanksgiving, 2 days after Thanksgiving, 3 days after Thanksgiving, for the 3 weeks before
Christmas,
the holidays start again, mm-hmm. You can watch what you do. And then it becomes very easy coming up with some of these very small changes that can lead you to mindlessly eat less, can put you on the right track, keep you on track, even though Thanksgiving was a blowout.
Well, you know, I'm going to get you on that word mindless, because actually there's an awful lot of mindfulness that goes into adjusting one's environment, one's eating environment. So you mentioned, for example, putting the high carb or the sugar items on another counter. So there's some mindfulness there. You also talk about something that, you know, I'm very attached to, and that is, you know, when I eat alone, I'm reading or listening to the radio or both.
Or on the computer even sometimes. Oh,
exactly. That's the other thing. Eating, you talk about desktop dining. So you talk about applying mindfulness to be able to mindlessly lose some weight.
And the idea about mindfulness is once you know what's leading you to eat 50, 75, 100 more calories of the mashed potatoes you just had or the dessert you just had, once you know what does that, just turning that around so it works for you and just do that habitually, it works real well. So we find that people who have the habit of meal stuffing, which is overeating meals a lot, one reason this occurs is because they're very fast eaters. They'll start eating, and they'll continue to eat until everybody at the table is through eating. It means taking seconds of this, thirds of that, seconds of this. And before you know it, they've consumed an immense number of calories just simply because they're waiting for other people to finish. Now, with these people, we'll videotape the dinners, and the next day we'll say, hey, how many helpings did you have last night of mashed potatoes? And they'll go, No, I think I had two. And you'll show them the videotape, and you'll say, would you believe four? Because the problem is they just mindlessly refill their plate. Doing something as simple as moving those heavy dishes, the starches and the foods, off the table just a few feet, whether it be back in the stove, or whether it be a sideboard, or whether it be a counter, I will guarantee will cut 30% of the calories out of most meal stuffers' dinners.
Finally, you had a very interesting chapter, I think, about kids. You know, the current generation of children is really on its way to be the fattest ever. Experts are forecasting an epidemic of diabetes down the road. You say that there's a change that happens in kids between the ages of 3 and 5 that can really set them up for trouble.
Oh, absolutely. We do. Well, the chapter that you mentioned in the book just a moment ago is called The Nutritional Gatekeepers. It's actually one of my favorite chapters because it really shows how the patterns that we've ended up developing or inheriting from our parents end up being the exact same patterns that we very carelessly pass on to our children. And with the big concern of childhood obesity, there ends up being an awful lot of finger-pointing at a lot of external forces that are external to the household, whether it be the food industry or the schools or the government. But the real encouraging thing is that there's very small shifts that most people can make in their patterns at home that really can put their kids back onto a good path. And we find that even at a very young age, between 3 and 5, we see big differences at daycare centers in the way different children eat. And we believe almost all of these can be traced back to the home.
So, for example, I mean, I think you say that, you know, until the age of 3, kids will stop when they're full, but that changes afterwards. It kind of the social influences then become more primary. Is that right?
Yeah. It used to be believed that children know when they're full, but that they lose this ability to determine this as they grow older, and they end up being very easily influenced simply by the size of the cereal box or the shape of a bowl, or by whether there's fun music playing in the background while they pour, something like this. And parents can have a really profound impact on children, both on sort of the variety of foods they end up eating, but then also on how frequently they eat. And we find that some of the kids, and this is an initial finding we talk about in the book, that some of the kids in our experiments end up having the healthiest eating habits, even as 5-year-olds, end up growing up in a family where there's a lot of variety of food that's been served to them as they've been growing up. As a result, they don't just have a taste for sugar, salt, and fatty foods.
You have something called the Popeye Project.
We
Popeye the Sailor Man. And actually, when I was a kid, I was told that spinach will make you strong like Popeye.
No, that's what's interesting. In 1928, there was a survey of children asking them what their 3 favorite foods were, and ice cream was one of the 3 favorite foods, and one of the other 3 was spinach. It's hard to believe that that was back when Popeye was being released, and there's such great associations that it worked hard. What we've done in the Popeye Project is we've gone around to talk to over 200 small children who are 4 to 5 years old, and we've asked them, hey, what's your favorite vegetable? And most of the kids don't really have one, but we started finding out there are certain kids who really had extreme favorites, like broccoli or something like seaweed or things like this. And when these non-kid-friendly vegetables would pop up as a child's favorite, we'd ask them a lot of questions, and then we'd ask their parents a lot of questions to try to figure out how they developed a taste for this stuff. And it's amazing because so many of these end up being driven by these really great associations these kids have. They're totally independent of the vegetables. So, for instance, we found these brothers that really liked broccoli. And we asked them why. They said, well, because it looks like dinosaur trees. And so, you know, it's kind of weird. But in interviewing their mom, we found that their mom had said, broccoli is like a dinosaur tree. And when you eat it, you're like a long necked green dinosaur eating a dinosaur tree. Hey, at the dinosaur loving age of 4, this is a great association.
That's wonderful. So associations not only work with adults, as in the case of the Cabernet from California, but with kids too.
Yeah, we did some studies at some vacation Bible schools where we renamed foods. And so I feel guilty about this one, but there's a kind of a V8 drink, kind of a tomatoey V8 drink. And we renamed it a rainforest smoothie. A rainforest smoothie. What we ended up finding out was we couldn't even keep the stuff in stock when we did that.
That's great. So, well, the book is Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. And Brian Wonson, thank you so much for talking with us on Writer's Voice.
Well, I appreciate it. The website, mindlesseating.org, has a whole lot more tips about this if you're interested.
Great. And we'll link to that on our website.
Perfect.
Wonderful. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.